Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. You know, the field of mathematics has a very colorful history. We find duels, we find courageous women, we find tombstones. Oh my goodness me. Our guest, Holly Attenborough, an associate professor of mathematics at UW-Platteville, is our guest. Holly earned her PhD in mathematics from Indiana University. She received the Alliant Energy Underkoffler Excellence in Teaching Award in 2021, excuse me. So we'll hear some stories from here of early mathematicians, learn about the evolution of math, and I hope you'll join in as we move along. If it's some stories relating to math, are you curious about the work of mathematicians? You might want to share some of your favorite math history facts. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Holly Attenborough, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. I know it's not a typical topic for this show, and I'm really excited to talk about it.
You know, my own history with math is varied a bit. I was pretty good in statistics. I had a lot of statistics courses throughout my graduate programs. But my the highlight of my career, I think, might go back to Euclid a little bit, because Euclid, I think, was the founder of geometry. And I had a geometry course from Miss Benson at Madison East High School. And I once, early in the semester, I got an F on a test that I hadn't studied for. And but then I got an A+ on a from her, which was the highlight of my high school career, on a paper I wrote on the geometry in nature. I still remember it. So I'd gone from an F to an A+.
Good job. I mean, you know, it's interesting, the right homework assignment or the right teacher, what it can pull out of you, right? So I'd say for me, even my journey to mathematics was accidental. In high school, I had wanted to be a medical doctor, but I took physiology. And I decided that memorizing the parts of the body was not for me, was not something that I wanted to do. But that would be an important part of being a doctor. So I went to my physiology teacher, who was having lunch with my math teacher. And I was 16, and I was like, I don't know what to do with my life. I can't be a doctor. Your class isn't connecting with me. And my math teacher said, have you considered studying math? But I liked the sound of doctor so much, I went through and got the PhD. Yes.
So we're both doctors. Yes. I'm philosophy, you're mathematics. So we have that going for us anyway. And I got an A+ in a geometry test. Oh, paper. Oh, my goodness me. Well, why is it important? Why should we be worried about history? Let me put it differently. Why is it important for modern math students to learn math history?
I think context is the number one, right? I think probably what pulled that A+ out for you was connecting the geometry to the natural world, which you're excited about, and that added context. And sometimes the context isn't necessarily an application, but knowing how the story has evolved. And I think if you understand that sometimes you're expected to learn hundreds of years of math in a 50-minute session, it took a long time to get X as a valuable tool to solve. They were doing mathematics with full-on sentences into even the 1500s. So I think understanding the large task that's being asked of you can add some context.
Lee in Rhinelander has something for us. Lee, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you doing, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was introduced to mathematics in my late teens, and it just absolutely grabbed hold of me because it was one of the things that had no ifs or maybes about to it. And I wound up becoming a custom home builder and own my own custom home building business and doing math. I mean, from the time you wake up till the time you go to sleep. But the nice part of it is there is no, like, maybes. And I just love it.
Lee, thanks for calling. Well, Lee says there's no maybes. Are there any maybes?
There are a few maybes. I hate to break it to Lee. I do think that people are really drawn to that sort of what is conceived as a black and white nature. But we have some maybes in mathematics that then also reach to some more interesting things. There are, there's something called the continuum hypothesis, but we can do math assuming it's true, and we can do math assuming it's false. And it's fascinating. It doesn't lead to necessarily any. So there are a little bit of maybes when you start to get quite a bit more abstract.
There you go. You can join in to 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Kurt in Chippewa Falls has something for us, so let's go there. Hi,
yeah,
Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you. I understand that the concept of zero as a number was considered heretical and demonic at one time, I think, in the Western Christian Church. Is that true?
Yes. Zero has a sordid history, as well as even negative numbers. It's really fascinating, those sorts of tools that we use today that explain real life and that we're very comfortable with, were approached with a lot of discomfort.
So what was do you know why the church was against zero?
Particularly with the church and zero, I'm not sure, but I think that there was a lot of, when we think about mathematics and its origin and that utilitarian need, it was describing things you have. So describing zero, where it describes the absence of something, doesn't really fit within the framework. Some things I do know that have been considered sort of blasphemous as well as, say, infinity. There's been a lot of controversy about infinity over the time.
Well, Kurt, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's talk about some of your favorite math stories. I understand your favorite, or at least one of them, involves Fermat's last theorem.
It is Fermat. He's a French lawyer, actually, and part-time mathematician. He was a mathematics enthusiast, and he would pose questions. He was extremely interested in number theory. And so his last theorem, so something I think that most people are familiar with from their high school geometry class would be that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Hopefully that sounds familiar.
Yes. does to me anyway.
I'll assume the silence of the listeners is that they're also on board. So we have the Pythagorean theorem that if we square these numbers, we can find integer solutions. So a common solution is 3 squared plus 4 squared is equal to 5 squared. And we can use that to describe the sides of a right triangle. Now, with Fermat's last theorem, he posed, what if the exponent isn't 2? What if we have a cubed plus b cubed equals c cubed? Or to the fourth power, or so forth. And so what I like about the question itself is it's sort of easily posed as an extension of the Pythagorean theorem. He posed it in the 1500s. That's when Fermat was alive. And by posed, his son was going through his belongings after Fermat passed away and found it written in one of his math books in the side and said, x to the n plus y to the n equals z to the n has no integer solutions or whole number solutions, like the 3, 4, 5, mm-hmm. if n is greater than 2. And then below it, he wrote, I have a marvelous proof of this theorem, which this margin is too small to contain. In French, though. So it sounded even more dramatic, I'm sure. And the theorem itself was not proven until 1995.
That's a long time.
Yes. So that covers a lot of math history there. And that sort of struggle to find or solve the solution. And what did it mean by Fermat had a proof? Was his proof wrong? Did he even have one? Was he just trying to excite the world with mathematics? And it certainly did. A lot of people struggled to solve the problem. And what I like most about the story isn't even necessarily the problem or the solution, but the struggle. And I think that brings it back to that mathematics classroom too. So we have people were posing solutions and they were wrong, but then people had to prove the posed solution was wrong. And then they had to try to fix it over and over again and fix it. And from trying to prove Fermat's last theorem, a tool was developed that is heavily used in advanced mathematics. It's called an ideal, but not to say what it is, but it's used all the time. I learned about it in my undergrad and I had no idea. It just came about because people were doing it wrong. And I think that's a message we need to send to our students, that sometimes if you're thoughtful about getting it wrong, it's super helpful.
You mentioned numbers theory, and somebody's probably, I'm sure, is already saying, what is numbers theory?
Yeah, thank you. Basically, the study of numbers and how they interact with each other. Typically, when we talk about number theory, there's a lot of questions about prime numbers and whole numbers. So those sort of numbers that you're used to thinking about, probably for if you're used to thinking about pi, that wouldn't quite fit into number theory. It's more about how those whole numbers interact with each other and say divisibility and things like that.
Our guest today, Holly Attenborough, Associate Professor of Mathematics at UW-Platteville. We're talking with her about the intriguing history of mathematics. Who would have thunk it? Actually, there's a timeline that goes back to, I think, the Stone Age, where the first mathematical tool was discovered. And we'll talk about that. And John from Boaz, we'll get to you as well. And also to you, questions or comments, or maybe a history question relating to mathematics or a story to tell, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Holly. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for spending your time with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about mathematics history with Holly Attenborough. Holly, an associate professor of mathematics at the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. It's great to have her with us. And lots of interest. Our lines are all filled, as a matter of fact, with folks who want to visit with you, Holly. You could also email us, the email address ideas@wpr.org, or you're going to get a busy signal if you try 800-642-1234. Joan and Boaz, let's go to you. Hi, Joan.
Hi, I'm John in Boaz.
Sorry, John.
I have a question for you, professors.
It involves
math. And how does a carpenter make the perfect right triangle? And I have a hint. She covered it before with the Pythagorean theorem.
Well,
three times three is 9. 4 times 4 is 16. You add the 2, 25, and the square root of 25
is 5.
Five.
It's 5, yeah.
And it makes a perfect right-angle triangle.
Well, is that the way carpenters work, Holly, I wonder?
Oh, not enough carpenters. Invite me in.
Oh, man. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Steve at Oxford, your turn.
Yeah, hi. I just like to ask to expand a little bit on the history of zero. When was it invented? I knew the Arabs invented it, but when was it invented, and how did they do math before?
Okay. Holly, what do you think?
Oh, that's a lot of questions. It depends, too. So I think one thing that we have to be careful about, too, when we talk about zero or number systems or even the history of mathematics, we weren't as global as we are now. And so lots of things were happening in parallel and various things. So at least in Mesopotamia, zero was invented around 3 BC. But we didn't adopt that numeral system in our Western mathematics nearly at that time. But also, you have the different ways that you use zero. You can use it as a quantity, right, to represent nothing. But if I were to write down the number 10, while it is kind of a quantity, it gets sort of confusing there how we're using zero. And so there's a whole long history of even getting to use zero as a placeholder. And interestingly enough, sometimes they would just leave blanks. So the number, say, 101 would look like 1 blank 1, which doesn't really distinguish from 11 very well, depending on handwriting too, right? So we have lots and lots of things going on there. So I would say it's a whole evolution throughout time until probably the adoption as well of the Arabic numeral system in Western culture. I got to some of the questions, I think.
I think you did. You did a pretty good job, as a matter of fact. And I had mentioned earlier, and somebody's going to say, what about this Stone Age business? But there was the Ishango bone. That was discovered, and it dates back to the Stone Age, apparently.
Oh, wow. I don't know about that one. I do know about the Rind papyrus as well, that has sort of a lot of math that dates back to 1500s BC. And so there is some certainly some ancient things that we get to make sense of, which is really fun.
Yeah, it's a fun thing. The bone itself was had distinct markings like a ruler.
Oh, for measurement. And here I was just thinking, yeah, that's modern ruler, or not early version of.
Kathleen in Madison, let's go to you. Hi, Kathleen. Kathleen, are you there?
I am.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I love math, and yet I was married to a man who was an English major, and he wrote a very funny piece about how math made him fat. And I just wanted to share that because he would have wanted me to share it. That's all I've got.
Okay. Well, no,
I'm glad you were able to find some common ground between the English and the math. I love the discipline of English. It was one of my other thoughts for a major. I think the way that I think about mathematics, and it all varies by mathematician or even whoever's engaging with it, is that it's often a logic puzzle. And writing, I'd say, a well-designed essay or even a poem about how math makes you fat could have some really interesting logic to puzzle through.
Speaking of fat, reminds me of pie. March 14th, so it's 314, is Pie Day. And here at Wisconsin Public Radio, several people will be baking pies and bringing them in, and we will all have a piece or two of pie on that. And there were a handful of mathematicians who spent time estimating pi. Archimedes was one, I guess.
Yeah, Archimedes, absolutely. So I think I think it's really nice, at least in English, that pi and pi are homonyms. And I think that's right, right? So, but when we think about the number pi, it comes from circles, right? It is the ratio of the circumference to the diameter. And when you think about, that's why it's nice to have a nice round pie. We better have round things. We can have pizza pies, all kinds of things for our Pi Day celebration. But circles are hard to measure. If we think even about to the bone example or rulers, they're really fixed, right? So how do you, when I say circumference, I mean the length of the perimeter of a circle.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you measure that to get an estimate of pi? And so Archimedes did it by doing, say, we could fit a square inside the circle and then maybe a five-sided figure or a 10-sided figure, because we can measure easily straight lines. It's the curved lines that are difficult. And that actually led to a lot of really interesting advanced mathematics, I think could even relate to the invention of calculus. I'm sorry, I get really excited. One thing, since we do have the upcoming Pi Day celebration, Ludolf van Suhlen, I'm certainly pronouncing it incorrectly, he was so proud of his estimation of pi that he had it engraved on his tombstone at 35 digits long, which in the 1500s was unthinkable.
That was long in the 1500s.
Yes, that is a lot of calculations by hand.
And our approximation of pi now is what? It's in the billions, isn't it, of digits?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
How the heck did we get there?
It'd be a hard thing to fit on a tombstone. But also, it's constantly getting broken now, right? Because we have such fast computing systems.
Oh, boy. And Kathleen brought up one other thing. She loves math. And I think there's some history of women having a difficult time getting into that field.
Absolutely. And I think with academia in general, right, there was certainly some gender divides. Relates back to Fermat's last theorem is Sophie Germain was very interested in Fermat's last theorem. And she was interested in mathematics in general. She was very excited by math. And her parents tried very hard to keep her from doing mathematics. There are stories of them not letting her light the fireplace, so she would get cold at night, or various things. But she would just wake up frozen because she was so excited to work and do on the mathematics. And she had a lot of she persevered quite a lot. And then at the time, ended up corresponding with a famous mathematician of the time by Gauss. But she hid her identity from him and said that, you know, wrote down she was a monsieur instead of a madame. French is coming back to me. Yes. It hit her identity. Interestingly, Gauss did not find out she was a woman until armed guards showed up at his door. Because the war had started, and she was so worried about Gauss, and she was of some wealth, so she sent people to check on him. And they're like, Madame Germain is very concerned. He's like, I don't know a Madame Germain. And he finds out it was this mathematician he'd been corresponding with.
Oh, a great story. Let's take some more calls here. I want to make sure we get some folks in. Ron in La Crosse, will give you a chance. Ron, thanks for calling.
Yeah, maybe your guess isn't old enough to remember it, but when I was attending a parochial school in the mid-60s, 1960s, they introduced something called the new math, and it was a combination of logic, set subsets, and geometry. And at first, the early chapters in this text, it was a thin book, was a piece of cake, but as I progressed through it during the seventh grade, it got more and more difficult. And also, I'd like to add that there was an episode of the 1980s ABC sitcom, The Wonder Years, where Kevin Arnold was having trouble with math, and he became jealous of his classmate, Paul Pfeiffer, who was good at it. And here's another connection. Kevin Arnold's girlfriend, played by Deanna McKellar, she eventually, I think she got a master's degree in math in some university in California, if you remember her, if you're old enough to remember that sitcom.
Well, she's not old enough to remember the sitcom, but you know of it, Holly.
Absolutely. I've seen it. I'm old enough to remember it from my childhood, which might not be the same time it was on air. But I do, yes, she got her master's in math. from the show, which is very interesting. She's also a strong advocate for women studying mathematics on the Bane of the Last.
Ron, thanks for that, for those comments. Appreciate it. Matthew in Wonder Lake, Illinois, will go to you. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks, Larry. Always such an enlightening show. I just have two quick questions. I just wondered if your guest knew about the Goldbach strong and weak conjectures about the prime even numbers being always sums of primes. And then I would love to hear what your favorite pie is, Larry. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Oh, well, we'll start with you, Holly.
I am familiar with Goldbach's conjecture that states that an even natural number, and so just again to put some context to that, that's those whole numbers. So even would be then 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So any even natural number greater than 10 is the sum of two primes. That's the conjecture. And that fits back to that number theory that we were talking about, how those numbers interact with each other, especially with the primes. It again is a one of a that has people are still talking about. So it was introduced in 1742 and it is still part of the conversation.
And I've hardly ever met a pie I didn't like, to be perfectly honest. It depends on the season. Now, coming up, we've got rhubarb season coming up pretty soon. And so rhubarb's going to be my favorite pie until maybe it's peach pie and then apple pie. But I guess if I had to pick one, my grandma Mueller's pecan pie, which my brother sat and watched and took copious notes while she made the pie, because he was trying to figure, he wanted to reproduce it exactly, and he detailed notes because she wasn't good on measuring. She had her own way, and it has never been duplicated. So let's put it that way. So if I could have my Grandma Mueller's pecan pie, I'd probably swear the other ones. There you go.
I would say grandmother's pies are by far the best pies. So my grandmother's blackberry pie, my grandma would be
your favorite.
Yeah.
Mary in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I heard on CBS that India wasn't adverse to the idea of infinity because of maybe Hinduism and Buddhism.
Mary, thanks for calling. Holly, what about that?
I don't know it, but I believe it. I mean, I think that there are really, especially when we think about how the mathematics was happening simultaneously and differently, and even in Western mathematics, there was some identification of infinity with God, and that's part of where it becomes blasphemous. In high-level mathematics, we actually have different infinities. There's more than one, which is really exciting for me. And can also be exciting to some of my students.
It can also be. You mean that's, and not all students, perhaps.
I'm really impressed with how many. So we have a course at Platteville, which is really fantastic, that's called Math Explorations. That is a first-year gen ed course, where we bring in some of this high-level math that doesn't necessarily need to go through calculus to get to. And so proving that there are more than one infinity is there. And I have one particular student, she was a Spanish major, who stopped me all the time to remind me how much she loved that.
Outstanding. Well, the Italians back in the 1500s had some fun with math. How did they duel?
So I think fun is an interesting description of the process. So in 1500s Italy, there were math duels. And by that, it would be that you could challenge someone to take their job. So, for example, Larry could send me a list of 30 math problems, and I could send him back a list of 30 math problems. And if he solves more than I do, Larry can then become a professor at Platteville and take my job.
That won't happen.
But it was happening in Italy. And so while I think it's a really fun story, that had to be extremely stressful.
Yeah, I imagine so. I understand you're learning more about Eastern mathematical history. Indian math just came up as a question here, but what about it?
Well, I think one thing that's really particularly interesting, so I am trying to branch out. Another course that I teach here at Platteville is called History of Math. And I always try to make sure to put a parentheses with the word sum in front of it, because we're not going to get through very much here in just this half hour, and even a semester isn't enough. And so trying to learn more and go beyond my Western bent. But one thing with Indian mathematics, they in medieval times, they would write their problems and solutions in verse as poems so that students could, that would be a way to solve and learn them.
That's a pretty cool, I guess we do a little of that here. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head, but I can't think of one, but you must have one or two.
I know that there are songs on YouTube that can help students remember things like the quadratic formula, but I also tell my students that I don't sing, so I'm grateful that YouTube exists for that mnemonic. Another interesting poem tidbit would be that Hans Christian Andersen wrote a poem that was the proof of Pythagorean theorem that was on the front page of a newspaper. So back to our carpenter and the Pythagorean theorem. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm willing to bet that your class evaluations for that history of math class are really good.
They were particularly good. Yeah. Well, they did want to write a few less papers.
Oh, Colby in Madison maybe has a... Colby, have you got a quick question for us?
Yeah, I was wondering, for somebody who's maybe in eighth grade or something and doesn't seem like they're going to go into one of the sciences or engineering, why study math? Like, why do we need to know math beyond just, you know, grocery store math to get us through our day?
So I think the interesting question there is need, right? So what do you need or versus why should you learn, right? So sometimes with mathematics, as with a lot of disciplines, it's about the problem solving process and how that can rewire your neurons to be a better problem solver. Mathematics as a discipline is well bent in logic and in problem solving. So the skills that you gain by working on these problems are incredibly valuable when we then extend them to other I would say disciplines or life engagements. But whether you necessarily will need or use calculus in your everyday life, probably not as much as you'll learn would use the thinking skills that it takes to solve one of those problems or to abstract things. I know I said calculus, but at the eighth grade level, that sort of algebra abstraction is a really useful way to parse through a lot of words.
I think that's a really good answer to that question, Colby, and I'm glad you asked it. So are you writing a book?
Not yet.
Well, you're already an associate professor, so maybe the need for publishing is down a little bit, but you sound like you really enjoy teaching and working with students in Platteville. A lot of math-oriented people there, students.
We do have a lot of STEM majors, which makes it's a nice place to be a math teacher because they need the math. But also, like I said, I really do like the gen ed where we're teaching not just the STEM majors. I think there's a lot of interesting ways to teach mathematics. And I'm grateful that Platteville gives me an opportunity to do so.
Well, Holly, it has been a pleasure talking with you. I hope we can do this again. We really didn't get through all of the history of mathematics here in 45 minutes. So thanks so much, and tell me you'll come back and be with us again at some point.
Absolutely.
All right, Holly. Thank you so much. Holly Attenborough, Associate Professor of Mathematics at UW-Platteville. Great to have her with us. We'll get her back sometime and do this again. Tomorrow, David Drake and Jamie Nack are back to share updates on Project Monitoring Red Foxes, among other things. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.